When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Hey everybody, welcome back to this week's episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm your host, Elise Glink, and I'm here to help you make really smart decisions about your financial life. But first, I want to give you a little bit of news. So all of the reports, the monthly sales reports, are coming in, and it looks like home buyers are back in force. They are out there buying all kinds of homes, and in fact, real estate agents have started to complain that there's really nothing left for them to sell. This is true particularly in the first-time buyer market, where the realtors are reporting the first-time home buyers have actually showed up in May, which is kind of a first time for that in a while. A number of months anyway, maybe even a couple of years. Who knows? We'll have to keep watching. But the most important thing is that homebuyers feel like there aren't a whole lot of homes to choose from. Realtors are saying there aren't a whole lot of homes to choose from. And experts who are the housing economists or people who are industry observers are noting that home prices are rising. And because of lack of inventory in the marketplace, competition is going to push those homes and push home prices up. So all of that is something for you to watch as we go into what is traditionally the slowest time of the year, the summer. But that may not be the case this year. We'll have to see how many homes come back on the marketplace. This spring, we also saw a whole lot of housing starts. So new construction kind of leapt in, and we saw a huge amount of housing starts in April and in May. If new homes come on the market, we could see home prices rise there as well. And certainly we're going to see a huge amount of interest given that there's so very little for everybody else to buy. Okay, now we've got a special Glinkonomics report for the week, and I think it's going to have a major impact on anyone who closes on a home after October 1st of this year. Get ready for Tila Respa, or Tila Respa, depending on how you pronounce it, which may be the acronym to end all acronyms in real estate. It stands for the Truth in Lending Act / Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, Integrated Mortgage Disclosures. See? You may also see the acronym TRID, T-R-I-D, refer to this as well. Okay, so here's the good news, is it's not going to affect you yet. This past week, the government delayed the implementation of the new Tila Respa change until the first day of October. The bad news for many is that once the new law takes effect, the changes to the process of getting a mortgage will be significant, especially for those real estate professionals who've been working in the residential side of the business for quite some time. The first major change is in the paperwork. The existing Truth in Lending statement is getting merged, somewhat, with the existing HUD-1 settlement statement. And what does this mean for most home buyers or mortgage borrowers? Closing agents, title companies, and closing attorneys will now deliver something called a closing disclosure statement to the borrower. The closing disclosure statement is a 5-page form that combines many aspects of the Truth in Lending form and the old HUD-1 settlement statement, also affectionately known as the RESPA statement. Now, in addition to the closing disclosure statement that is given to the borrower and not to the seller, the buyer and the seller will then sign a settlement statement. The new settlement statement has a very different look than the old HUD-1 settlement statement, and since most buyers and sellers found the old HUD-1 form to be fairly incomprehensible, you'd hope that a redesign would make it, just a little more clear where the cash is going to and coming from in the closing. Unfortunately, I'm not sure the new form is going to strike most buyers and sellers as much of an improvement. In my view, the key to clarity in the closing of real estate transactions lies with the person working with the borrower or buyer at the closing, like a real estate attorney. There are all kinds of timing issues and things that industry pros are worried may cause lenders to keep pushing back the closing dates. As the summer continues, you can bet I'm going to have a whole lot more to say on this issue, particularly as we get close to the October 1st deadline. That's because anybody who's now going to be closing at the end of September faces a real issue with timing if you get to, say, September 30th or September 29th, and suddenly the lender tells you that the closing is being pushed to October 5th. You may find that in addition to that, there's a whole long disclosure process that you now have to go through that you didn't have to go through if you actually managed to get the deal closed in September. So you can bet we're going to talk a whole lot more about this. Feel free to reach out with questions on Twitter during our Twitter chat on June 25th at Glink or questions at thinklink.com. So join me Thursday at 1 o'clock Eastern, noon Central, 10 o'clock Pacific time for our Tyler Respa chat or hashtag TRIDCHAT, Trid Chat, and we'll go over all the details. Okay, let's get on with the rest of today's show. My guest this week is Frank Nodhoff. He is the chief economist at CoreLogic. CoreLogic is a real estate and property analytics firm based in Irvine, California. CoreLogic has a new report out on negative equity in the housing market, and for the first time in a while, it's mostly good news. So you'll get to hear Frank's thoughts on where the housing market is headed and what challenges remain for the rest of 2015. And he and I are also going to talk a little bit about some recent employment numbers and what I think and he thinks they could mean for real estate investors and just regular home buyers and sellers. And here's a quick preview. Long-range estimates predict an increasing number of renters in the years to come, so landlords may be better positioned than anybody else for the future. After my interview with Frank, I'll summarize a short report from Trulia on the average cost to get an apartment with in-unit laundry machines in different metro areas across the U.S. The key finding is how much the average cost for that convenience varies by city. It was remarkable in some places. In some of the cheapest markets, getting an apartment that actually has a washer and dryer is practically a wash, puns intended. But you'll be amazed at how much that same feature costs everywhere else. So that's the lineup for this week. Let's get started. CoreLogic has just put out its negative equity report for the first quarter of 2015. So I thought it would be a good time to chat with my good friend, Frank Nodhoff, again. He's CoreLogic's Senior Vice President and Chief Economist. And I wanted to get his perspective on the housing market and just overall on the economy. So I'm going to start off by getting his take on negative equity trends. And then we're going to seg, I hope, into a discussion that'll touch on some really other important topics like jobs. Frank, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
It's great to have you be here with me. So let's talk about the CoreLogic negative equity report. What did you find?
Well, we found some good news, namely that the number of households that have negative equity reduced over the past year. In fact, it was down 1.2 million households. So that's good news. The flip side of the coin is that there are still 10% of homeowners with a mortgage, or in other words, about 5 million homeowners who still remain underwater. Now, we expect house prices to continue to rise over the course of the next 12 months. We expect about a 5% appreciation in homes across the U.S. And if that happens, that'll help to lift another 1 million of those underwater homeowners and place them right side up a year from now.
All right, so let me jump in and just ask you some questions about that, because a 5% increase in home valuations, when home valuations are already at pretty much the top that they've been at, you know, and homes typically appreciate at a rate just above inflation, and we have like zero inflation out there. How do you get to 5%? And is that 5% distributed equally? Or really because places in New York are now on the market for $500 million?
Well, it would be nice if it was distributed evenly, but it certainly isn't. There are some markets that are a lot more hot than other markets. You mentioned Manhattan and the New York City area. That's one of the hot markets right now. Another one is San Francisco and actually a lot of the Pacific Coast. That's all very hot, too. And there are other parts of the market that probably are cooling off, such as those are markets that have a lot of energy-related production employment. Those markets are probably going to cool off over the course of the next year unless we see a turnaround in energy prices. So it's not going to be a uniform 5% appreciation.
All right.
The reason I think that prices will continue to rise is that we do see markets very tight, very lean supply of homes for sale in markets around the country. And that provides a necessary ingredient for helping to support further house price gains. And even with the gains we've seen so far, house prices in the national index are still close to 10% down from where they were at the peak in 2006. So I think there's a little bit more room for prices to go up.
But to be fair, that whole peak market in 2006, and I understand that was 9 years ago, was sort of artificially inflated. I mean, we reached those prices because people were getting mortgages with, like, nothing down. They were inflating. There was a whole lot of mortgage fraud going on. It wasn't, there's some people who feel like it should never have been even close to that.
Well, and I agree with that. But even with the inflation that we've had, and it's been moderate, very moderate inflation over the last 9 years, house prices adjusted for inflation are probably still about 30% below where they were in 2006. So they're down about 10% in nominal terms. But once you account for inflation that we've had over the last 9 years or so, they're down by almost 30% in real terms. So I think there is room for prices still to go a bit higher.
How do prices, in your mind, tie directly to jobs and what's going on there? When you don't see middle income or median income really move in 20 years, other than mortgage interest rates being, you know, incredibly low at near historic lows, I would say they're always, you know, just kind of touching those, that rate. You know, aside from mortgage interest rates being low, if median income isn't changing, how does that correlate into continually rising home prices?
Well, you point out one of the important headwinds that's holding back further progress in the housing recovery. The while the labor market has improved over the last few years, and in fact, in the last year, has created 3 million new jobs in the U.S. economy, there's still a lot of discouraged workers who have not come back into the workforce. So there are different metrics on the health of the labor market. One of them is the unemployment rate. That's down to 5.5% nationwide. That looks like a good figure, and it is a good figure. We have produced 3 million jobs over the last year. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of people who are discouraged workers, have not come back into the workforce. So if you look at a broader measure of labor underutilization in the U.S., that figure is above 10% of the workforce is not utilized fully. Now, that includes discouraged workers, people who are forced to take part-time jobs because they can't find full-time work. So there's no question that one of the things that's has been holding back the housing recovery the last few years is the sluggish pace of recovery in the labor market, and that is a headwind.
So this larger thing that you're talking about, the larger unemployment rate of 10%, that's what is normally called the U6, right? So the broader measure of unemployment?
That's correct.
So when you look at that number, which is somewhere between 10 and 11%, and you look at how many people are out of the job market that should be working but aren't working, how do you feel that, you know, the pricing will continue? I know I've asked you this, I'm going to ask you just in a little bit of a different way, but if the jobs that are being created, and there have been a lot of jobs created, but the jobs that are created are more low income, minimum wage, we're getting a one-time lift with this movement up for the minimum wage, and perhaps in some markets it'll even go to $15 an hour. That will have a significant impact. But overall, wages are not increasing, and the number of jobs in sort of that middle range, which is what sort of the middle income America had lived on, those jobs, which were very much in the line of manufacturing and are now kind of low-end service jobs, those prices, those job incomes don't seem to be going up at the same rate as housing. And so, and this moves me into my next thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is that all of the new reports are showing the number of renters between now and 2030 increasing dramatically over the number of new home buyers who are out there. So you end up in a situation where maybe as many as 75-77% of all households created will be renters instead of buyers, particularly important in that millennial group. How does that factor into what you're going to see in terms of home valuation?
I think the demographics are fascinating right now, Elise, and I'm glad you brought up the millennials. because we've seen some very important developments among that cohort just recently. One thing that I think is so interesting about the millennials, and it might be related to the fact that the labor market was just so lousy the last few years, is that many of them stayed in school and actually completed a college degree. The millennial cohort, by educational attainment, is the most highly educated cohort that we have seen enter the housing market. There's a larger percentage of the cohort with college degrees, and that sets them in a good position for forming households and for progressing into home ownership at a later date. Not now, probably not the next few years, but at a later date. The average age for a first-time home buyer has edged up, and it's more like about 30, 31 years of age. And the millennials are a really big cohort. In fact, number of people by single year of age in the U.S., the largest single year of age of population are those folks who are aged 23, 24, 25 today in the U.S. So that's the key ages for forming households, moving out from relatives, from parents, and they'll start off in the rental market, and that's why I agree the outlook for the rental market is going to be very strong the next few years. But they will transition into the home ownership market at a later time, and I think the outlook for the home sales market over the next several years is actually pretty positive.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I don't know. The Urban Institute just released its latest numbers, and it shows that, I want to say, something like 9 million people between now and 2030 are going to be buying a home, and something like, you know, 20 million are not going to be buying a home. They're going to be renting. And millennials, you know, I know that realtors and home builders are desperate to have more people buy homes. But it just really seems to be that it's going to focus on this rental market. Doesn't mean that real estate agents won't have anything to do. They're going to be buying and selling property for people, but it's going to be more investment property to investors rather than anything else. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the next 15 years. But the trend right now certainly looks to be that 31, which is, as you point out, the average age of buying a first home may jump up to maybe 35, 37. And that is as life expands, right? So we don't, you know, you might live to be 100. Maybe buying your first home at 37 is a good thing.
Yeah, well, and that may very well come to pass. I think one of the really interesting trends that you were underscoring, Elise, was the fact that we have seen a large part of the single family detached housing stock move from owner to rental over the last 7 years. Since the peak and during the bust of the housing market. So agents may be selling more investment or rental houses going forward. It's very interesting. The number of single-family detached houses that were in the rental housing stock increased by almost 30%, increased by about 3 million houses between 2006 and 2013. So there's no question there's been a big shift in that direction.
It'll be interesting to see how that shifts back and if the millennials and younger people ever realize that when you're renting, you're paying somebody else's mortgage for them. And when you own, at least you're paying it for yourself. We'll see if they figure that out. Frank, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Elise.
Frank Nothaf is the Senior Vice President and Chief Economist at CoreLogic. You're sitting in your apartment. It's late on a Sunday. Another work week is about to start. And suddenly, you realize you have a whole pile of laundry you meant to do on Saturday, but you need it for Monday. And now you've got no choice but to trudge down to the laundry room, or worse, to the laundromat, to supervise your underwear as it goes through the washer and dryer. What a pain. At that moment, you've got to be thinking you'd pay almost anything to have a washer-dryer inside your rental unit, right? I'm Elise Kling. Here's today's update. If you're a renter, then you've probably already done the cost-benefit analysis on whether it's worth paying extra for in-unit laundry facilities. And there's no question it's the more convenient option. But sometimes, it just isn't worth the extra money. So thanks to the diligence of the folks at Trulia, we now have a breakdown of what kind of premium in-unit laundry commands for renters in 13 major markets. And it's quite the range. I actually thought this was pretty interesting. If you live in Seattle, Atlanta, Dallas, or Miami, then you should go ahead and spring for the apartment with a washer dryer. It'll cost you less than $80 a month on average. And all things considered, that seems like a worthwhile amount to spend for a whole lot of convenience, especially on Sunday nights. But in Philly, San Francisco, and Boston, your laundry facility convenience comes at a much higher cost, northwards of an additional $200 a month. And in LA, this is amazing, you'll spend an almost unbelievable $325 more per month for an apartment with in-unit laundry on average. Let's hope that if you're going to spend $325 a month just to have the convenience, it also includes the cost of the water. Probably not. It's LA. California's in a drought. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And as always, I wanted to give a big shout out to Frank Nodaff for being on the show with me. If there was anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinklink.com. That's thinkglink.com. And if you're new to the show, I would love it if you would subscribe. And if you're a regular listener and haven't already done so, would you please consider giving the show a rating and or a review on iTunes? You can do that by searching for the Elise Glink Show in the podcast section of iTunes, and this helps the show get discovered by new people. I'd also love it if you forwarded it to all your friends. This brings us to the end of another episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm still your host, Elise Glink, and I'll be back with a new episode next week. Thanks for listening, everybody. Why? This brings us to the end of another episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm still your host, Elise Glink, and I'll be back next week with another new episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great week.